Welcome to the Weekly Juice Podcast, where we discuss all things real estate,
personal finance,
investing,
entrepreneurship,
and the many ways to achieve financial independence. We interview accomplished investors and entrepreneurs
with the goal
that their stories inspire you
to take control of your financial future.
Here to get your creative juices flowing while also documenting their own personal investing journeys are your hosts, Corey Jacobson and Ryan Bevilacqua.
Welcome back to the Weekly Juice Podcast. As always, it's your boys here with another episode for you. Today we had on special guest Jonathan Dempsey, aka JD. He is a real estate investor and agent that went from zero to 22 properties owned in a four-year span, increasing his net worth to over $1 million by age 28. In the last 18 months, he has also created a short-term rental property management portfolio of over 200 units across multiple cities, ranging from the Jersey Shore to Honolulu to Costa Rica. More importantly, we talked about in the episode, Philadelphia and the Poconos. Mm-hmm. So he's got things pretty much everywhere, but he specializes in short-term rentals, seller financing, business growth, and management.
Yeah, very cool dude. And we love that he was in our backyard, right? We're Philly guys, mm-hmm. and he lives in Philly. He talked about the differences in renting out his properties in Philadelphia, the Poconos, and how he built his entire portfolio based on short-term rentals, which is really cool in today's day and age. And then he just is about to close on, I don't know if he's just about to close or he already did close on the 43 units property in the Poconos. It's going to make a great return for people who follow him on Instagram. He built a network of investors that trust him and like him. And he's somebody that I could see us doing business with in the future. I thought it was a great episode.
Super analytical guy. And that's, I think, one thing that you need on your team is a person that's very strong with the numbers. And he doesn't have a W-2 job anymore. So he's consistently, like, what I want to make known here is that the reason there's so much competition or feels like there's so much competition out in the market is investors that have 9-to-5 jobs, unfortunately, have a little bit of a leg down when they go to research, analyze, and find properties, because guys like JD, they have a whole team that every single day, that's all they're doing is researching, running numbers, finding amazing deals, then they get sniped off the market. So this is kind of cool to hear a little bit behind the curtains on how things work and how they find these deals and the numbers they run. And he'll give you the run of show on how they do things on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. And he doesn't just do this so that he can try to build this massive portfolio with no end in sight and try to build this big empire. His whole thing is live free with JD. That's his Instagram handle, at live free with JD. So he's doing it to live free, to be able to have a life of travel. He loves travel. And I think that that's ultimately kind of what we want to do. So we really resonated. We kind of hit it off on the episode. I think you'll probably notice it as we go out throughout the show. But without further ado, I think we should bring in JD.
Let's bring him in. Look, guys, going mobile for managing your properties is the next big thing for real estate investing. When we're hunting for deals, we're consistently go, go, go. And having Rent Ready's property management app is great for checking in on all your properties, especially during rent time. With Rent Ready, you get mobile and web apps to collect rent from anywhere, instant notifications when rent is paid, and automatic rent reminders and late fees right to your phone. From finding the perfect tenant to collecting rent, everything you need to build wealth while managing your investment portfolio is now under one roof with Rent Ready. And just for our Weekly Juice listeners, Rent Ready has given us a special 50% off code. All you have to do is go to rentready.com, that's rentredi.com, and use our code JUICEPOD. That is JUICEPOD, and you'll get 50% off any Rent Ready plan. As you know, we talk a lot about financial independence, building revenue streams, and buying yourself more income. Wanted to give our listeners a special opportunity to potentially add a different revenue stream for themselves and into their portfolio. Tune into episode 110 to hear Corey and I peel back a couple layers on something that we're investing in currently at the moment. Just gives you a snapshot of where we are in our journey and gives you the opportunity to invest as well. This specific opportunity is to invest in a YouTube content monetization channel. And we go through every single step of the way, how we got involved and all the ins and outs of it. If you're interested after listening to the episode, feel free to drop us a DM. We're happy to answer any questions that you have and we'll point you in the right direction. JD, officially welcome to the Weekly Juice Podcast. Corey and I are very excited to have you on the show. I know we were talking a little bit pre-recording, but we align very much in our values and you are doing some incredible things. So we just wanted to officially welcome you and say thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I knew we have a lot in common and it's going to be a lot of fun to get in the weeds here today.
Absolutely. So if you could just give a little brief background on yourself, who you are, where you're from, and then how you got into real estate investing.
Yeah, sure. So I'm from Philadelphia, and that's where my investment journey started, right in your guys' backyard, ironically. So I had been living with a friend. I was renting a room. I was renting his attic out and living in his attic. And I realized, like, every month when I was making that payment, that I needed to get into house hacking. So that's kind of how it all started. I bought my first house to house hack. And then to get to where I was today, where the switch kind of clicked in my head to get into short-term rentals is I had an extra room available in my house. I had a buddy who wanted to move in, couldn't move in for a few months. So I furnished it and Airbnb'd it until he could move in. And I was making enough money on just that spare room Airbnb to cover the mortgage. So my other roommates were just cash flow. And I realized if one room in a 4-bedroom house could cover the mortgage, I really need to get in this game and do the whole house at once and get moving from there. So that's when it really clicked. And since then, I've just been pushing that short-term rental market as hard as I could to try to scale up.
Love it, man. I'm curious what you did before real estate. I know that you're an agent now, but prior to getting into real estate, is that the first thing that you did out of college? Like, did you go right into being a real estate agent?
No, I was all over the place, man. So I started out of college. I was managing a gym for a couple months, and the hours were just crazy. It was 6 days a week. The schedule was 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. With a couple hours break in between to lift. So I was in awesome shape, but I didn't really have a life outside of that. So after doing that for a while, I think it was about a year. I just quit the job. I had a ton of money saved up from working sales at the gym. And I just went on a cross-country road trip for 6 weeks, to reflect. I went all the way around the country, like in a huge circle. And in that time, that's when I realized, like, I don't ever really want to work like a real job again. There's so much more that I wanted to go see and do. When I did get back, I got into an insurance job just to try to make some more money. And I was on that insurance path, and that's when I ended up moving in with that friend that I had mentioned. He worked in insurance. He helped me get a pretty good job in insurance. I was studying to be an actuary, which basically is a fancy word to be a data scientist, to price different assurances and annuities and whatnot. So I've always been super good with numbers. And then that's helped me a lot with being able to underwrite rentals and get into real estate, and understand that side of things. But I knew I didn't want to work a job. And after I had enough rentals, I knew it was time to switch and start to get back to kind of that road tripping lifestyle and living my life again.
I love that you use the skill set that you had as a way to get into real estate. It's funny they say you were insurance, and this is no knock on insurance because it's so needed, but that was my first job out of college too. I was doing like employee benefits, which is maybe not the same type of insurance you were doing. And I hated every second of it. I was making like 100 calls a day. I didn't know what anything about it. And it was just, it was horrible. But it's funny because I got to be kind of good with numbers too. And that's a skill set that I brought into like the real estate investing and in the sales and in that sphere. So I think that's really cool. So once you went on this road trip, it sounds like that you kind of maybe have like a thought change or like a mindset shift. Did you then learn about like the whole financial independence movement at that same time?
Yeah, it was right around that same time. I really picked up reading as a habit. I got into Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which most people who get into real estate investing do. And then once I moved in with my friend and saw him house hacking, like all of it just kind of clicked at one time. And it was a little difficult for me. I'd say one of my biggest challenges was that most of my friends, most of my family, none of them were in real estate. No one understood it all. So when I told them, like, and I was all hyped up after reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad to get into real estate, everyone thought I was crazy. Even my girlfriend's family at the time was her dad was super successful. He had a couple of rentals, and even he was like, "Oh, you should just keep your regular job and try to make a good career out of it." So that was pretty discouraging, but I just did it anyway. And now we're here.
That's awesome. So I love that story, by the way, and you just kept powering through. So let's talk financial independence in general. Like, what does it mean to you? And then can you take us through what the Live Free movement is?
Yeah, absolutely. So financial independence to me is being able to do whatever it is that you want every day. And that could be having as much fun as you want, going places and traveling and not working. But it also means like you have all the time in the day to work on whatever you want to work on. And that's kind of where I'm at now is I spend the time I want building out the business, trying to make it flow a lot more smoothly, and making sure it's a well-oiled machine. But then I travel a lot. I've been to 15 different cities for 5 days in each one in the last 15 weeks. So I've basically spent every week the last 15 weeks in a different city in the country. And the Live Free movement to me is just about finding a way to get your passive income to a point that you can do that, that you're spending the time exactly how you want to do it, that you're not using your whole life to work a job and spending 65 on seeing the world and doing the things that you've dreamt of. But finding a way to get passive income so that while you're young and you have the energy, now you have the time to really go do all of these things that that you've dreamed of.
I love that. And I've seen on your social, you've been personally been in Hawaii for, I mean, maybe it's, I don't know if you're there for a long period of time, but it seems like one of your second homes at this point. But you wouldn't be able to do that without all this passive income, right? And just going to have these experiences is such an incredible thing. And I think a lot of people see that on Instagram, and they always see the end product, but they don't really know how to get there. And I think this episode, what we want to do is kind of peel back some of the layers and give the how-to on certain things. So can you dive us into the like ins and outs of your portfolio? Like, what is it comprised of as of right now? I believe you are a 28-year-old millionaire, if I'm correct. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. I hit it at about 28 and a half. I hit the mark.
Congratulations.
So the portfolio is almost entirely short-term rentals. Most of them are in Philadelphia. I have some single families. I have a duplex. It's all luxury. It's all new construction or fully renovated places. And then I have a handful of places up in the Poconos as well. I had a pretty sick seller financed 7-unit deal up there that really kickstarted the portfolio up there. And I've been buying a couple single families up there too. But it's all short-term rentals. The only time I rent long-term is to my friends who are part of the Live Free movement, who help work in the management company. So I give them the, what we call the homie discount on rent. and that way we can all work and kick it and keep pushing our goals together.
Love that, man. So how did you get involved in the short-term rental space? And because a lot of people that get involved in real estate investing in general, they maybe start with a duplex or a triplex or a quad, they kind of stack a few here, and then short-term rental, obviously it's more of a new thing. What made you decide to dive in on that right away, and how did you learn about it?
Yeah. So I probably would have been one of those same guys doing just long-term rent. That's what you hear everywhere is to get a multifamily, and that space is really crowded. Like I said earlier, I got really lucky that I rented that spare room out and found short-term rentals. That one spare room made $2,000 that month in net income just on a spare room. And the same house, if I had it on the long-term market, probably would have made $2,200 at the time. So then I bought my second one down the street in Philadelphia, and there's a huge advantage in Philadelphia. And I'm sure you guys know this being right in the backyard, in that anything that's new construction gets a 10-year tax abatement. So you don't pay any property tax on new construction, which was just kind of the perfect combination for short-term rentals for me. I got really lucky that I was living in a city that has all this going on, but for any Airbnb guests, when you're looking for a place and now I can offer something at a super competitive rate, that's brand new, has a roof deck, super close to everything in the city, it was just the perfect mix to attract guests. So when I ended up buying my second house and putting that on the market, I was netting $5,000-$6,000 a month, leaving me with $2,500-$3,500 worth of net cash flow every month. And the more I stacked those things up, the easier it was to kind of walk away from that W-2 job.
For people that don't realize what the tax abatements are, and you kind of explained it there, but we're talking about adding in a new construction area in Philadelphia and an up and coming or a place that people would want to rent Airbnbs. You're talking about probably somewhere between $400 and $800 a month. $800 would probably be a little high, but like for Philly, more so Jersey, but like somewhere in that range, that $400 to $800 a month, right to your bottom line. And that is right there, a home run long-term deal, having that just that minimum cash flow there. So to be able to add that to your bottom line and go through an entire market cycle in 10 years. I mean, 10 years is enough time in any market to come out of a recession, out of a deep hole, and which we, knock on wood, haven't been in since for 12 or 13 years. So I think that is a real thing. And in Philadelphia, it is a huge advantage. I've thought about buying new construction for that reason alone. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. It's pretty cool.
You see that in a lot of different cities too. A lot of cities have their own version of it. I haven't seen one quite as good as Philly's, where there's just nothing for 10 years and you're only paying on the land. So that, like you said, a $400 to $800 increase in the bottom line, it really changes the game.
So it's interesting to talk about short-term rentals in an urban market like Philly, right? I think a lot of people always think about like, okay, the Poconos, definitely, right? It's a mountain place and that, or a mountainscape in the background. And then you think about like, let's call it Florida, like Destin, Florida, and then also Orlando, right? For Disney. But it's interesting to have it like plopped in a city. For me, I'm thinking, at least because we know this because we've experienced it, but like, Philly is obsessed with their sports. And so I'm thinking like, hey, when the Eagles games, like every Sunday that there's a home Eagles game, your place is probably popping off. I'm not sure if that's true or not. Can you talk to like what success you've seen in Philly and what you think leads to that?
Yeah, totally. So I get this question a lot because a lot of my friends and family are from Philly and they're like, we know Philly. Who is staying in Philly? Like, why are people coming to be in Philly? And I think that's kind of an effect that you guys and I have, that we would think the same thing. But if you check on any of these sites, AirDNA, Price Labs, whatever it is, you can see how many bookings are coming through, and they're there. Believe it or not, a lot of it is not tailored to the sports. There's other cities that the sports make a huge difference. And I agree that Phillies fans, any Philadelphia sports team, their fans are some of the, they're just the most committed fans that you might see. But those don't really impact the bookings as much as you think. We have about 20 units out in Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh, the rates will jack up double, triple every time the Penguins are playing or the Steelers are playing, which is awesome. It would be super cool if that happened in Philly. But Philly, just somehow, maybe it's because it's such a big city and there's so many Airbnbs, that the inflation on pricing when this happens is, there's not that much of an adjustment. It definitely helps with the occupancy. But if you're trying to double your price when the Eagles are playing, there's too many other players in the space and you're going to get beat.
Interesting. Okay. That's a good perspective. I appreciate that. Also thinking too, just cause we're in Philly guys at this point, is like a lot of people in the summer, they're like, hey, I'm just hitting the shore. Like everyone's literally down the Jersey Shore. So do you guys have any market share down there, any properties? And then, cause I feel like everyone's like, oh, you should get a shore house. You're going to see a ton of cash flow. And I'm thinking like, all right, well, if you go down the shore, there's only like X amount of months that those things will be viable. And then in the winter, when no one's there, how do they sustain themselves? So do you have any insight there?
Yeah, totally. And a lot of this comes from my father consistently pestering me on why we should get a shore house, and me reminding him why the numbers don't work quite as well. And I think this is what happens in markets like Florida, and other hot destination markets, like you mentioned earlier. There are so many people that naturally want to go there. There's big attractions, and that puts so many investors' eyeballs on that market. So there's just so many people looking to get that. And there's so many people who want to use it recreationally that people start to get emotionally invested in what they're doing and the property they're purchasing. Whereas they're starting to forego looking at the numbers because they know they're going to be able to use it. And when those two play into the game, you as an investor can't really compete and make the same offers. And the revenue doesn't look as good. Whereas I think there's a market in the urban market where there are so many corporate opportunities. There are so many people in Philadelphia as an example. There have been so many businesses coming into Philadelphia and so many buildings with so many workers that you get people in there for a month at a time who just moved and they need something furnished because they're not ready to buy. They haven't found their rental yet, but you lock them in for $6,000 a month on somewhere that would normally rent for $2,400. And all you did was add furniture. There's a huge opportunity there. And then a lot of urban markets, there aren't many places you can go and stay with a ton of different people at one time. You're not going to get the same experience booking six hotel rooms with your friends as you would if you booked just a huge house in Philadelphia, and you're not going to get the same experience.
Yeah, I think this is something that we're just noticing now, whereas we always felt like we live in Philly. I love Philadelphia. I think it's amazing, but I wouldn't exactly think of it as a place that a ton of people would want to visit. Like I don't see it like that, but people forget that every city has something to offer, and Philadelphia is a historic city and people have family everywhere too. And now people are substituting Airbnbs for hotels. Or vice versa. So there's just always a market, especially in a Philadelphia city that's I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but I think it's a top 5 or 7 population-wise city in the United States. So there's constant movement. There's constant people coming in and out. So if you're in a city, and there may be regulations different like NYC or San Francisco, but if you're in a big city, just because you've been there your whole life and you don't want to stay there and visit, there doesn't mean that other people wouldn't. And I think that that's something that even me, I'm in the Northwest section of Philadelphia, I could probably rent my house out short term. And I never thought of it before up until the past month or two. So I think it's just something to note for people that are maybe currently house hacking or want to do what you did and build a portfolio of short-term rentals.
Yeah, totally. And that happens in a lot of suburbs as well. It really comes down to how many places are available and how much demand there is. In Wayne, for example, one of the suburbs of Philly, we have a couple of houses in Ardmore, Wayne area, and they do fantastically well. And the reason that is there are so many people who have houses out there who would never think of putting their house on Airbnb. They just think of it as home, whereas there are people who are relocating pretty close to that area for work, and they're going to rent it out for 6, 9, 12 months at a time at such a premium because there's nowhere else to rent and they don't want to get something that's so much farther from where they're trying to be.
Wow. That's wild. And there's a kind of a taste for everybody too. Like not everybody wants to be like, some people want to rent out a place with a big yard that seems like a family home. Like, so you were going to say something, yeah. But I just think it's great.
Well, that's interesting too. I'm thinking, I always thought that if you do like short-term rental, you said 6 to 8, 6, 8, 9 months.
Like midterm, right?
Yeah. Is that like a midterm rental or, and does that, is that something that goes on Airbnb or is it something that's on like a, like kind of like an internal sourcing? I don't know.
We have our own internal sourcing for that. So that's one of the niches that our company hits is those medium-term rentals. We have a person dedicated solely to listing and getting in tenants that are going to rent for 1 to 11 months. We specifically don't allow 1-year leases, and we charge a pretty hefty premium for that. And we're really catering to those type of clients. We've had pretty high name individuals from HGTV. We've had Barstool Sports in our units. We've had a bunch of different professional athletes, and that's a huge market in Philly. It's not actually the fans that are coming, but all the athletes that they're watching, they want to stay somewhere really nice while they're there for the season. They don't know how long they're going to be on the team. They might not want to live in Philly all the time. So they just rent a place that they can be at while they're there during the season.
Wow. That's really cool. Now I'm thinking of like how you're underwriting these deals and what you're looking at specifically. For example, the rule of thumb, if you're looking at a long-term rental, it's really hard to do this now even, but if you're buying a property for $200,000, can you get $2,000 a month in rent, i.e. the 1% rule? It's really difficult to do. But what is there a specific rule or something that you follow in order to try to price these long-term or the short-term rentals out and try to see if something is a good deal? Because we know it's getting more difficult. And right now in this space, the way the market's moving is that it almost, in a lot of markets, short-term rentals are like some of the only ways to make properties cash flow at all. So it's a little bit of a dangerous space because you never know how if it's going to be here forever. But I don't think people are going to stop traveling. COVID proved that. If you can travel through that, you're not going to stop traveling. So what's a way that you underwrite these deals? Is there something specific that you look for?
Yeah, definitely. And the 1% rule is kind of it. And it depends on the market. So there's certain markets where I'll look for the 1.5% rule. And then there's other markets where Philly, for example, 1% rule is cool for me for net income because of the tax abatement. Because 1% in Philly is pretty much 1.5% anywhere else with that abatement in place. So it's really, it depends on the market. I know the markets that I'm in pretty well. And as you get more familiar with the market and you underwrite more deals, you'll set a different threshold. So for example, in the Poconos, I might look for $1,500 in cash flow for every $300,000 invested. And it really just depends on the market. There's different thresholds you want to hit, but cash on cash is a big indicator. And I wouldn't touch anything less than 20% cash on cash.
Very cool. Thanks. So I want to transition to your companies a little bit and talk about those. And then we'll get into some more numbers down towards the later half of the episode. Let's talk Liberty City Living. Can you talk about who the team is made up of and then what services you guys offer?
Yeah, totally. So we pretty much have two different subsidiaries that do two totally different things. We have the management company that has about 51 people working in it. And we do full-fledged short-term rental property management. So everything from A to Z, whether it's furnishing the property, getting the photos done, hiring the cleaners, getting all the cleans scheduled, taking care of all the communications, any maintenance that comes up, we do all the guest communication. You name it, it's handled from us. All you have to do is submit your bank info and you get paid out every month. We send you a portal so you can see all the reservations that come in. You can see it live. You can see how many guests are staying. You can see what they paid. You can see if they extended. Everything is covered in the management. And then the other side of things is our sales team. So we also have a team of agents who source properties. We probably get three pretty fire deals every day and about 15 that are just okay, that come across our desk, because they're just constantly scouring the MLS, Zillow, anywhere that you can find a property, they're on there sending through deals. And that team helps our clients buy more properties and extend their portfolio. It's also where we source our own deals and try to go out and acquire new things.
Wow, that's been incredible.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what are you typically seeing in the market for charging for property management? I know that what we've been told is that, and our property manager charges us 8% for long-term rentals. We've seen as high as up as 25% for short-term rentals. Where do you play in that space? And like, why do you feel like what you charge is the correct amount?
Yeah. So I'd say most short-term rental companies are operating anywhere between 15% and 25%. Just because short-term rentals involve so much more intensive management than a long-term deal. I've seen long-term companies do anywhere from like 6 to 12, and it really depends on the market. We charge 20% and it's all encompassing. I still think we might be a little too low, but I started this company for one, managing my own rentals, and two, managing rentals for my friends and family. So to me, it's not even about creating a huge profit from the property management end, but more so just creating the right systems and getting the right people in place so that the properties are managed correctly and returning the most to the investors that are buying these properties.
Very cool. So there's so many ins and outs here that we can dive into on the short-term rental space, but what sets your company apart to like get 5-star reviews? Like, I'm just thinking about all the different Airbnbs I'll see out in the market, right? Let's pick the Poconos for example. And like, there's a bunch of different cabins. Like why would someone rent out one of your cabins over someone else's? Is it based on customer service, the layout? Like, can you just talk about to kind of like, you know, why someone should go with your company and pay the 20% versus maybe, you know, 15% with someone else?
Yeah, totally. And a lot of our clients do come from other huge property management names. I'm not going to throw any out there because I don't want to throw companies under the bus, but there are some companies that charge less than we do. And the services you get, you just see a lot of lacking in a lot of those different aspects of a short-term rental that I spoke about earlier. For example, like if I ping one of our competitors' listings, you might get an answer in 8 to 12 hours. With our team, the average response, no matter when you ask us anything, is 4 minutes. So you could be hitting us up at 3 a.m. tonight and we'll get back to you within 4 minutes on anything that you have. One of the major components that sets us apart, we have someone in charge of every aspect of short-term rentals. And we have a team that backs them up on everything. So we have a chief of operations who oversees all of our cleaning directors, who oversees all of our maintenance, oversees all of our comms team. And then we have a team of concierges that are actually all within 15 minutes of any given property that can go out there and help the guests with anything they might need. Those same concierges are checking every property and every clean to make sure that everything is spot on before you get there. A lot of our properties will leave bottles of wine, will leave handwritten notes. There's just a lot of things that we do to make sure that the guest experience is 5-star. And that all goes back to why I started the company, is to make sure my rentals and my friends and family's rentals are getting that best experience so that the bottom line is as high as it can be. And you're proud to show people you're listening.
Love that, man. So there's a big difference, obviously, in between renting out your property short-term in an urban market like Philadelphia, we just talked about, and then maybe like the Poconos or a rural market. What do you think the main differences are? I can probably guess. It's to me, tell me if I'm wrong, is Philadelphia has a higher occupancy rate, but maybe the more rural areas that have more like skiing and water sports in the summer, maybe that they're rented for higher, but not as often. Is that something that you're seeing specifically? Because I'm curious, I'm sure you're running the numbers differently like you would, or that you would in a city versus like a rural place.
Yeah. And it really all comes down to the guests that you're attracting. You're definitely right on the spot with those theories. And it comes down to who you're catering your rental to, right? Like I said, in cities, you might get much longer reservations for people who are trying to work out of that unit or are relocating to the area. So you want to make sure they have a dedicated workspace. You want to make sure that they're going to be comfortable like living there. Whereas in the Poconos, you're only going to get people there for 2 to 7 days. You're not going to be renting your house out for a month. So you want to make sure that you have a lot of fun stuff for them to do. They know where everything nearby is that's fun. It's much more of an experience in that market. So you want to make it an experience for them however you can with where they're staying.
I love it, man. So let's say that we want to find a company that can take us from A to Z on acquiring a short-term rental. Let's say we bought a property with your company. What would be the ways that we hand it off to you? Could you take us through like maybe a step-by-step process of purchasing through management and what your team handles?
Yeah, totally. So we do all that underwriting. We source all the properties. We find those hidden gems for you. We will send you periodic updates as we find them. And then once you find a house that works for you, we help you figure out what to submit as an offer, submit the offer, get it under contract. The only part you have to do on your end is take care of your financing. We can introduce you to a lender, but we can't go through the lending process for you. And you guys own several properties yourselves. You know what that lending piece looks like. So other than the mortgage piece, we're ready for everything else. So let's say you're about to close on a property. You're 2 weeks away from closing. Our interior design team will have already been in touch with you weeks prior, set a design for the house, sent it to you. You can go in and pick out and change things as you wish and kind of pick the design and be involved in that process. And then they'll have everything ready to order so that on the day of closing, you have everything starting to arrive and the team will be there to assemble everything and your listing will be up within 3 to 5 days after close. So that way, instead of most people who try to close and then buy all the stuff and assemble it themselves, a lot of the more mom and pops, they're offline for the first month to 2 months getting their place set up. Whereas you now are collecting that revenue for the right out the gate in that first 3 to 5 days your listing's up. So we get that all set up and then we give you that backend portal so you can see all the reservations coming in. You don't really have to do anything from there except for watch the 5-star reviews and the money come in.
Take my money, JD. Yeah. That's seriously incredible. And I think the reason we wanted to ask that question is we have a lot of friends and investors that I think everybody just is pressed for time these days, right? Like a lot of people really want to get involved in real estate investing. And you hear, you know, it's kind of the sexy thing for short-term rentals these days. And people are like, listen, I have money saved up, but I don't have the time or the confidence really in myself to go find this thing and then run it properly, having not done so. Granted, you're going to see some people, maybe that 5% that go do it, but the 95 are just, they're kind of left out to dry. So I think you have a really competitive advantage or a very big competitive advantage in the market, but also just like in the industry by having an all-encompassing team. It's absolutely incredible. Like Corey and I have a gentleman that we're connected with down south, and he has this for the long-term rentals. And we're like, listen, this is amazing. Like we didn't even know they made them like you. And to find you up here in our backyard for short-term rentals, it's like a diamond in the rough. So I think a lot of people listening are just going to be very excited to hear more about your company.
Yeah. And not only that, JD, I want to point this out that real estate investing is so much more passive than having a W-2 job, right? Significantly more. But if you manage your properties yourself, it's a lot less passive, a lot. So Ryan and I are the types of people that we want to build the genuine relationships with individuals around us who can help take us to ultimate passivity, right? I would rather, if I had a portfolio of, let's say, 45 units, and I'm just throwing numbers out there, let's say that made $15,000 a month in cash flow. I don't even know if those numbers are right. But the point is that if that took me 25 or 30 hours a week to get to that point, it would be like near having a full-time job, right? So the point would be to scale away from that. I would much rather make $9,000 a month in passive income and partner with somebody who does what you do to have our workload be scaled back from 30 hours a week to 7 hours a week, if that, right? So that is the whole game here. And with the short-term rental space, you're able to have more cash flow coming in. And then yes, you're paying more for management, but there's also more of a spread there to pay a company like yourself. So I think it's a new thing, a new market, a new experience. But if people are willing to dive in, I don't think vacationing midterm, short-term is really going anywhere. So I just want to point that out.
Yeah, I totally agree. And to speak to your point there, it's, the reason we all get started with real estate is the same reason I started Live Free Movement and got into financial freedom. We don't want to work. We want to have our time freed up. So having management in place is a necessary evil, if you will. And that's why I created it for myself and built out the company, is so that I could have my time to do what I wanted to do with it. If I wanted to just get rid of everyone in the management company and try to handle everything myself. One, I would never be able to do it. Two, you would never see me off of my phone. And it just wouldn't be worth it. I think it was around 6 units that I just was glued to my phone all the time, and around 10 units where I just needed help to come on. So
cool. So we mentioned earlier in the show that you have a number of these properties, right? And there's kind of this fallacy, or maybe it's true, that after you get to a certain amount of mortgages, I think the number's around 10, is that's really hard to get more. So how are you able to bypass that, maybe using something like seller financing? What was the strategy for you to be able to grow your portfolio specifically to the point that you did without running into that problem with the banks?
Yeah, sure. So the first handful of rentals all came from house hacking. I would buy a house, a year later I would move, or even shorter than a year later. Lenders will allow you to move sooner if you're moving into a bigger, better house, a more expensive house, whatever the case may be. So just by moving every year and switching where I was house hacking and then turning the old place into a short-term rental, I was able to acquire the first 6 or so. After that, I had to get creative. That's when I started going after some seller financing deals, or I just kind of sucked it up and I put 15% down. A lot of times at this point, one, you can get a lot of advantages by doing that and doing what's called a DSCR loan. As long as the income from the property is going to cover the debt, you're good. They don't ask you for any more documents. They just do an appraisal based on how much income's coming in, and you're good. And with how messy my finances are at this point, by not having to submit a million documents to underwriting and just be able to go with that DSCR loan, it's super helpful. But seller financing has been a big key to it. We're partnering with some other people who would help put up some of the cash and kind of help hop on title to get the loan cleared. That was another way that I got moved forward.
Very cool. Can you talk to, just like in layman's terms, like what is at the basic root of it, like seller financing, and how, like, I don't know, I'm just thinking like, how could I explain this to like a kindergartner? You know what I mean? And maybe that's not the best analogy, but we hear this all the time. People are like, yeah, we got really creative with our deal. And you can do so many different things with this, right? If you don't have to go to a bank. So maybe talk to what it is and then a specific deal where you used it.
Yeah, sure. So seller financing only is going to happen in a select few situations. And I'll cover like when it's good to try to go for that seller financing route. But really what all seller financing is, to put it in layman's terms, is the seller is the bank. So it's just you and the seller. They have the property. You're agreeing to buy it from them. You make your own terms with them, and there's no lender involved. So it cuts out a huge, tedious part of the process, and it allows you to go in and tweak all the different terms of the lending to what works for the both of you and the seller. And that creates a huge advantage, because sometimes they don't need nearly as many things as the lender does. A lot of times, if you find the right situation, you can put down a lot less money by making the interest rate a little higher or playing with other little terms in the deal, so that maybe you don't have a ton of cash. You can get in, they're making more money because you were able to agree to a purchase price that would never appraise, or whatever the case is, if there was a lender involved, and they're getting interest. So they're not getting hit with a huge tax burden when it comes time to sell with the capital gains that they had, and instead just taking it in chunks over years at a time. So seller financing is essentially the seller's the bank, and you can create a lot of win-wins based on the terms that you guys are able to come up with.
Perfect. Excellent. That's very well said. So thank you. I'd like to get into maybe the specifics of a deal that you've walked through or done. Maybe if you want to talk about the numbers, the type of property, kind of where you found it, purchase price, what it cash flows for. We have 2 deals that maybe you could choose from. I know you're looking at a 43 unit deal or a 16 unit deal in North Carolina. I don't know if either of these have closed, so maybe you don't want to jinx yourself, but pick a deal, even if it's not one of these, and just walk us through kind of the process, the numbers, what it cash flows, how you finance it, and just give us the lowdown.
Yeah, sure. So I'll do the 43 unit deal. That's one that
big boy.
I'm super excited about.
I was just over here like heavy breathing, like 43, dude, 43. We got to get this one.
I know he's jacked to talk about it. So let us have it, man. It's very exciting.
There are so many interesting pieces to this deal, and I can kind of get into seller financing just a tad more on that one. So for this one, after doing some homework, I realized that the sellers have had it for a while. They have a ton of equity in the deal. And what I do on a lot of my deals that are a little bit larger or funkier is I'll offer the seller 2 different offers. One that has seller financing terms that are a little more favorable in terms of purchase price or interest, so that maybe they'll take it if they're in position. You never know where their head's at. And then I'll offer with bank terms that's a little lower to try to make the seller financing more attractive. I did that on this 43 unit. It's a whole saga. I initially had them good to go with seller financing. I had a partner on that deal who was dragging his feet a little bit. And by the time we went to close on it and get the seller financing under contract, someone else had actually gotten the deal. Fast forward 2 months, the other person had fallen out of contract and we were able to come back in, beat out a couple of other competing offers and got the place under contract. So it's 43 units up in the Poconos. These 43 units are kind of different. 15 of them are apartment style and the other 28 are little like cabins and bungalows and just like your typical, like what someone going to the Poconos would want to stay in. They're all nice and secluded. The property's on 11 acres. So there's just a ton of space and a ton you can do with the property. The owners had it all as a long-term rental. So the place is bringing in about $34,000 a month with long-term rent. So for all the multifamily guys out there, the commercial guys, $34,000 a month in long-term rent, it's a $4.325 million purchase price. So it's operating at about an 8 cap right now as long-term, which is great in that space. But that's not our end goal with it. So our plan is to put about $450,000 into renovations. We've got the contractor lined up. We're ready to go. All the lending set. We're just waiting on the appraisal to come back, which should be probably today or tomorrow. We're expecting the place to be worth about $5.8 million when we're done with the renovations. So we're going to slowly kick out some of those month-to-month tenants just in those smaller units that we can renovate and make those cabins just look 10 times better. You guys have seen some of the places in the Poconos that have like the tongue and groove wood paneling that have kind of that rustic but modern luxury charm to them. So that's what we're going to go in and do is renovate all the bathrooms, renovate all the interiors. We're going to put fireplaces around all the exteriors and fire pits for people to hang out. Hoping to pull out about half of the money that we had to put down on the property just on the refi. So it's kind of a Burr style deal that we're turning into a Burr B&B.
Burr B&B, I love it. So what do you think, what's your anticipated number that you think it's going to cash flow when it's all said and done after rehab?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So the net operating income is going to get to about $599,000, just call it $600,000. Which is going to put us at almost a 14% cap rate, which is awesome in real estate, especially this time. Like you said earlier, it's really hard to find a deal that works. And a 14 cap is a good spot. The cash flow is about $22,000 over everything. So it's going to be cranking out a pretty good amount of money. And that's after the refi. So we've already gotten half of our money back within the first year from refiing. Now we have $22,000 a month coming in. And the total amount we needed to put down for this deal was about $1 million.
Whoa, dude, let's talk about that too. So that's another interesting part of the deal, right? Is like, you can talk big numbers and have an amazing deal in front of you, but it's to get $1 million isn't cheap for anyone, right? So can you talk to how you source the cash and then like how many partners you have in the deal and like, you know, kind of like how people are paid out? I'm thinking of like, are some people equity partners? And then do you distribute cash flow out of that 22,000? Like who, you know, how's it divvied up?
Yeah, sure. And that was one of the really interesting aspects of this deal is raising the money, because when I was negotiating with the seller, when I saw this place, when I got the vision for how this could turn out, I didn't have any money available. And all of this money was going to have to be raised by investors. Obviously, I'm putting some money in and putting some skin in the game on this deal, everything that I can, probably about $100,000 worth. I'll be bringing to closing, but the other $900,000 had to be raised. I have some experience fundraising, but never something to this caliber. So what we ended up doing is, with the way that the deal is so attractive, all the units are rented out. So as we renovate, there's not going to be any negative cash flow or holding costs because we'll cover those. After we renovate, that refi is going to bring about half the money back. So I basically just pitched all of my friends and family on, hey, you're going to be able to get half your money back right away because we're waterfalling everything that this deal is bringing in right back to investors. So I'll eat last is kind of how that I like to phrase it, in that everyone's going to get half their money back on the refi, and that $22,000 a month in cash flow, if you bake that out over the course of a year, that's almost a quarter of a million. So over the course of 2 years, that's another half million. So investors will all have their money back within 2 years on this deal. And then after that, they remain as equity partners, are going to remain to get cash flow from there. So we basically equity partner everything out. You agree to put in a certain amount of money. You get a certain percent equity in this resort. You get all your money back in 2 years, and then you're still an owner of the resort thereafter.
Boom. Done. That's awesome. So it just goes to show that you don't need to be this like fancy dude in a suit syndicating, like, you know, doing all this stuff with accredited investors. You can go to friends and family, people that trust you, people that see what you're doing on social media, people that follow you, people that watch you are growing your portfolio. And it's something that Ryan and I have not dove into. I don't know if it's a fit for us yet, but doing that type of thing, maybe we're more on the passive side, who knows, but we have a lot of people that trust us. So I think it's very, very cool that if you build a network, you build a following, build people that trust you, you can take down a 43 unit in at 28 years old. So amazing.
Yeah. And I think you guys could totally get into that space. You're super personable. You've built a network, and that's a key component. And you guys have passion in what you do. And I think that's really how I was able to raise the funds. I didn't really have many friends and family come into this deal. A lot of it's social media or past clients who have some rentals with us and see how these short-term processes work, and they're making good money. They want a good opportunity. So I would just present it to past clients as well. And really the money's just kind of come in through that time. So if you're passionate about a deal, I always say that if it's a good deal, the money will come. So you've got to lock it up and the rest will take care of itself.
Certainly, man. Finding the deals is harder than finding the money. We've learned that time and time again, because we're ones looking for the deals and we have the money. So it's, I love that. Thank you for breaking that down. I think that deal, I hope it works out for the best for you. So I know it will. Now we're at winding down the show a little bit. Before we get into the last two segments, I want to talk about the Live Free podcast. And I know you're a fellow podcast host, which is pretty cool. It's a relatively new show, but tell us about the Live Free podcast and why you started it and what was the whole idea behind it.
Yeah. So the idea behind the podcast was just to get out there all of the different things that we're doing. My fellow co-host, Mike and I, we both just spend our entire day diving into real estate, whether it's looking for cool listings, short-term rentals. We both don't have jobs and this is all that we do. So we're traveling all over to cool places. We're going to look and stay in cool places. And we just kind of wanted to share everything that we have going on with other people who may be like-minded and want to get on the same path as we are. So anyone who's interested in financial independence, we're just trying to talk about all the ways that we get creative to make it happen for ourselves. So we have a couple more people to come hang out with us when we're trying to live free.
Dude, I already want to hang out with you. Let's do it.
You can come stay in the Poconos whenever you want. Once the 43 unit is up, we'll go up there.
We're in, dude. You talked about former gym, managing a gym. We can hit the gym, hit the beach,
dude, chill,
maybe a little ATV in.
Yeah, love it. I know the Poconos is super fun. I used to ski. I got a concussion and haven't gone back, but I think in the next year or so, I'm headed back out there.
Your boy's bachelor party.
We did like paintballing. You go up there, you can do water sports. That was in the summer.
There was an indoor pool it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
I just love that area. It's super
camping, exciting. Outdoors, fires, drinking, hanging with friends. It's great.
It's amazing.
Cool. So I think we made it to the core four.
We did. You want me to start it off?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. All right. So core four, second to last segment of the show, just to get to know you a little bit more on a personal level. We asked the same four questions to each of our guests. So we'll keep it easy for you on the first question. But what is your favorite business or investing book that you feel has helped you take your life to the next level, or maybe your business to the next level?
My favorite book is Essentialism by Greg McKeown. This book changed my whole life. The premise of the book is that you need to focus only on things that are essential. And for me, what that did was I spent all of my time kind of separating from my phone, from social media, from anything else going on, and just focused on what key aspects of the business could be improved and how to improve them. Since the day that I opened that book, my phone's been on do not disturb. And if you ask anyone in my network, I'm one of the hardest people to reach. I don't pride myself in that. It's not always a good thing, but if you really need to reach me, you'll be able to reach me. And that book was a big reason for that, is I stay super focused on the things that are the most important to me. I consistently update a list of things that are important, and that's what I'll be working on.
Wow, that's very interesting. If you don't mind me asking a follow-up question on that. So you're a real estate agent too. I know you have 1,000 things going on. So how do people get in touch with you on, like, if they need to? I mean, you shouldn't be readily available every second, but like, how does that actually work?
Yeah. So at this point in my agent life, I'm not doing much agent work. I kind of take the upfront, I'll take the initial phone call and handle leads and generate leads for the people on my team who are, they're really putting their nose to the grindstone. They're finding the sick listings. They just don't have the network to kind of move these houses the way that I do. So I make sure I have a team who's able to spend their time and really dedicate all of their time to helping out clients. And I pass those clients off after the initial phone call.
Great so system. It's exactly what we would want.
That's the brunt of it. That way I can stay focused on what's essential to me and what's essential to the agents on my team is helping those clients. And it's a win-win for everybody.
Very cool. So question two, let's say, you know, we realize that you're now a millionaire, new millionaire, which is great. Let's say we had $50,000, we handed it to you right now. What specifically would you do with it? Would you put it into a real estate deal? Would you splurge on something? Would you add it to the renovation of something? What would you do with an extra 50 grand right now in today's market?
If I'm me or if I'm an investor?
If you're you.
Just you, and it can be personal too. It doesn't have to be in specifically like, hey, this is how you recommend someone invest it. But just like if you got an additional 50K cash tax-free right now, what are you doing with it?
Yeah, well, I guess it really doesn't matter if it is me or the investor, because what I would do with it, for me, I would put it in one of those two deals that we were going to cover, either the 43 unit or the 16 unit. I'm scrounging up every penny I can get in because a 2-year return time is awesome. And I'm really passionate about that project. I want to see something super cool come to life. Returns are great. The only other thing I would consider doing with it is buying one of the listings that recently came up. There was a $500,000 house in the Poconos that came up, and it's generating cash flow or cash of about $112,000 a year. So that coming up, that was certainly tempting to move some money into, but I'm all locked up in the Poconos.
Woo! So see what you did there, bro.
Well, yeah, damn. All right, we're going to push.
If we have any good luck, that thing will be off the market in about 30 minutes.
This episode is no longer releasing. Okay, no, I'm just kidding. So that's hilarious.
That's great. Three. So I'll go three. Yeah. Third question of the core four is, what has been your biggest mistake that you have made along your investing journey, and how have you learned from it?
So it's really about, like, I get super interested in things and I tend to dive into the things a little too fast. The way I got started with real estate, I was buying houses in Philadelphia and doing Airbnbs without really knowing that market super well. I got lucky and a lot of the houses I picked out ended up working out for me. But the mistake I make is going head first. The first house I bought in the Poconos didn't do so great. There ended up being a lot of things under the hood that weren't found in the inspection. And that's something I've had to pay for. So it's really about just making sure you do all of your due diligence on any deal, and really learn a market before you hop right into it.
So on that deal, it's just kind of cool to go, you know, we don't talk mistakes throughout the whole episode, right? It's usually successes, but it's kind of cool. So what was wrong with the property? And then how did you climb yourself out of that hole? Do you still have the property or did you have to, how'd you maneuver?
Yeah. So, it was kind of difficult. So it was a single family house up in the Poconos, super sick place, 16 person hot tub, super aesthetic house. And it was making really good money off the bat when we first had it up, but the water lines in the house and the septic system ended up failing. Two things that just weren't caught on the home inspection that are just super expensive repairs. So what I did, I actually raised money from some friends and family for that deal. So when it's offline, it's just killer, because that's my reputation getting hit. And I feel horrible that my friends and family aren't getting returns after putting some money in. Some people pledging like most of what they had saved up. So what I did is I volunteered to pay them out personally, guaranteed return out of my own pocket, while the property was down. And then at this point, we're probably going to have to do a small cash call to investors to get the septic tank put back up. But once it's back up, the house will be cooking again, and we should be good. But that was definitely one of the biggest challenges that I've faced is, one, as someone who's syndicating, having to make a cash call, But luckily it was on a small deal and the first syndication. And now I've done a couple successful ones since then. And things are flowing a lot more smoothly.
It's awesome. You got to go through that stuff, man. I'm glad you're on your way out. It's good.
Cool. So question number four, last of the core four, what do you want your legacy to be, JD? Why do you do what you do every day? Why do you get up out of bed? You're financially free, or you're a millionaire, which is amazing, but what keeps you going?
Yeah. So for me, it's all of the people in the Live Free movement and all of the people that I can see have that same passion that I had when I first got started and really want to create a better life for themselves. So a little more about the Live Free movement is it, a lot of the people who join, we all do this program called 75 Hard. Everyone goes through a really extensive 75-day challenge. You can't be in our program until after you've completed that. And all of these people are starting their own businesses, which usually are ancillary to what we do. So an example, there's one guy in our business who started his interior design firm and does all of our Airbnbs now. And he's one of the toughest guys and one of the hardest workers I've met. He's done 90 houses in the past year, furnished them top to bottom. He's the monster. So for me at this point with having so much cash flow, I don't need an expensive lifestyle other than traveling. I don't really spend money. I don't wear flashy clothes. I don't really buy fancy things. I have all the money I can need. So it's really about building out systems and making this real estate portfolio as big as I can so that every time I grab 43 units, I can help friends and family get great returns. I can help all these guys in Live Free Movement gain another 43 design jobs and really push their businesses to the next level so that they can have the life that they want.
So I'm really glad you brought up 75 Hard because I did it February 7th to March to May to April 23rd. And I remember it like that because it did change my life and the outlook that I had on the things that I didn't think I could do. So I was like, I was going to the gym 3 days a week thinking that I didn't have enough time to go more than that, thinking to myself, Oh, what do you mean? And then I realized when I put myself to a challenge like this, going working out once a day outside and once a day in the gym for 45 minutes, I changed my mindset on what I could accomplish. And there's other things in the challenge too, but I love 75 Hard. I think it was amazing. I'm going to do it again at some point. I like to drink and have fun and do all that stuff, but for the 75 days, no alcohol on a following a diet, it helped me frame like what I didn't realize that I could do. So that's awesome that you make people do that. I think, everyone's like, it's so hard, it's so difficult. And I thought the same thing. And then I just did it. And I was like, well, I'm not going to just not do it. I'm just going to do it. And when you think you're not going to do it and you just decide to do it, that's it. That's all it was. When I didn't want to do something, I just did it. And I love that, man. I love 75 Hard. It's Andy Frisella.
Yeah.
Frisella. Yeah.
Awesome. Acting like I know about it. I fucking didn't do it.
you could.
So I'm next. Yeah. Well, I guess I'm next, boys. But yeah, you guys are cut from the same cloth. That's really cool.
Really the biggest part about that challenge or anything like it is the mental change that you get. Like you said, the things you think you're capable of. One of my favorite two pieces of that, as you get further into it is you have to make a power list of five things that you're absolutely going to do that day before you go to bed. And that's something that jump-started my business or anything that I was working on. Because if you're doing things that you committed to doing every day, you're never going to be standing still. You're constantly going to be getting better as you move forward. And the other big piece of that challenge is you have to read every day. So you're constantly learning. You're constantly getting things done. There's really no way for you to fail or move backwards in your life while you're on that program. I've done it 3 times at this point. I'll probably continue to do it more and more in the future. That's the big reason of the success I've been able to create in getting 23 rentals and managing over 200 in just a couple of years.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. I've learned this recently, doing super, super hard things like 75 Hard consistently makes the very hard things not as hard. So you're able to do something that's really, really hard. And then you run across something that's pretty hard and you're like, wow, it's not as hard as something else I just did. So it makes you, it gives you the ability to accomplish so much more. So I can talk about that for hours, but I love that you did that. I love the mindset shift. I know we talk about mindset a lot, but it's truly powerful. So it looks like we made it to the last drop.
We have.
Cool.
So last segment of the show is one last question for you before we wrap up. But knowing what you know now, if you could go back to, let's say, 18 to 20-year-old JD, what advice would you give him knowing the things you know now?
I would have got started with real estate way earlier. I would focus on getting into networks of people who had what I wanted and are doing what I wish I was doing way sooner. That's something I spent way too much time trying to please my parents, please other people, live the same life as my friends out of college. I was living in New York, going out to happy hours 3 to 5 times a week, because that's what you kind of had to do to move up in the company and network. And it took me too long to realize that the life that everyone around me had and was looking to get was not the same as mine. So if I could go back, I would get started and try to become an agent, learn everything about real estate that I could, and just try to stack as much money and get into the rental game as soon as possible.
Love that. Awesome, man. So first of all, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate your time. We've learned a lot from you. Hopefully we're able to do some business together in the future. But if people really liked your story, they want to learn more about you, network, maybe invest in your team, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So I would say send an inquiry on libertycityliving.com. That's an easy way to get in touch with me, or honestly hitting me up on social media. Instagram is at livefreewithjd. That's by far the easiest way to get in touch with me and get started with what we got going on.
Love it, man. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. So cool to learn about you and your story. And I love that we're in each other's backyard.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you guys so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. I know we're going to meet up sometime soon and have some fun.
Can't wait, man. Thank you again. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in this week to the Weekly Juice Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and share with friends. The more ratings we get, the more ears we'll get on our show, and in turn, we'll be able to provide you with more high-quality guests. You can also find us on Instagram at Weekly Juice Pod, where we post daily tips and tricks and document our own journey towards financial freedom. Make sure to tune in every Wednesday to get your weekly juice.